Here at Saturday Extra, we're not in the habit of gratuitously terrifying you with news stories, despite a few good candidates, but we felt we needed to air the overt worrying underway among the world's key economic thinkers about the state of the world's economy. The former World Bank chief economist Kaushik Basu ended a big analysis piece recently with a sobering "Adopt the Brace" position. There's consensus that a toxic combination of populism, protectionism and nationalism is haunting countries from Brazil to the UK. Plus, we all came to know about QE, quantitative easing, characterised as central banks printing money to ease GFC conditions. Well, it's been replaced by QT, quantitative tightening, trying to move back to more normal circumstances. And a few years back, good commentators remarked then that moving out of the QE experiment would be bracing. Well, we're here. So what do we all need to know? Forewarned is, after all, forearmed. I'm joined by one of the most respected economic thinkers, Dr. Ken Rogoff. He's Professor of Public Policy and Economics at Harvard, a former economics chief of the IMF, and renowned for charting the history of booms and busts over 800 years. Peter Brain's been analysing Australian economics for many years. He's from the National Institute of Economics and Industry Research based in Melbourne. And Peter Martin joins us too, now business and economy editor at The Conversation and part of the popular RN offering The Economists. Welcome to you all, gentlemen.
G'day.
Greetings.
Dr. Rogoff, should we be adopting the brace position? Are we heading for another financial crisis sooner than we think?
Well, I hate to predict there won't be one and then have one come, but I think that's a bit hyperbolic. I think the real big story is what's going on in China. I think China is really having a more sustained slowdown. I wouldn't necessarily say it's going to have a crash, but think of it as a soft landing on a downward hill. It centralizing power the way President Xi has for the last many years might be good for keeping the Communist Party in power, but it's not good for productivity. And the housing boom, which they've used for so long to prop up the economy, really does seem to be coming to an end. You know, elsewhere, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with Brexit. Italy could blow up. I mean, there's concerns in Europe. Europe's certainly not doing well, but we're not talking about necessarily the same kind of dramatic thing that's going on in China. And the United States, although in partisan civil war to some extent, the economy is doing great. So, you know, it's a mix of things. I don't think the, you know, risks of a financial crisis are particularly acute. Although I've got to tell you, one happened right now. We don't have the A team in charge in a lot of key countries to try to manage it.
No, although you have said in your writing that key central banks still by and large have excellent staff and leadership. The trouble is crisis management of the sort that happened, and we absolutely know about this in Australia, involved this truly remarkable symbiotic relationship between all our best institutions. It was quite something to behold. You're not, if I read you correctly, you're not sure that that is available right now.
Well, I think the central banks are fine. It's just the big things that you have to do if you're really faced with a crisis involve using government funds. So in the US, the Congress needs to approve it, and the UK Parliament needs to approve it. And there's just political paralysis. And I'd also say, I try not to be political, but certainly within the Trump administration, there's not a lot of competence in dealing with these kind of things. It's a little scary. And you go across to the United Kingdom, and they have good people in their treasury, but you know they're throwing themselves into the Northern Sea without even having any crisis.
Yes. So it's really about politics as much as, well, maybe more than economics by the sound of you. Although, may I say, the caveat is that quite a lot of very distinguished people just seem to feel that that economic boost in the US, it just can't go on the way it is at the moment.
I don't share that. I mean, there are people like my colleague, Larry Summers, who's sort of a, you know, been very insightful, but he says it's all a sugar high from the tax cuts. And I don't think that's right. I think we're still coming out of the financial crisis. There's a lot of ground we get back from that. And business confidence is very high, believe it or not, with everything going on. You know, China's much more dramatic. Now, you mentioned populism. That's sort of a slow burn. It's not necessarily something that's going to blow up into a recession. I think, for example, in the United States, if the left takes power, they have, you know, a lot of ideas of what to do, involve spending money, printing debt. And I actually think it'll work fine for a while. It's just that it will lay the seeds for a big problem down the road.
Right. So for you, if and with this very this marvelous encyclopedic knowledge that you and your colleague Carmen Reinhart assembled in terms of looking at booms and busts over the years, you're not sending up a flare that there are major dangers on the immediate horizon.
China. We don't even know what's going on in China. I mean, who believes the data? I don't think they're falsifying it. I just think they don't have very good data on an economy that size. I mean, everybody gets excited because the growth rate falls from 6.5 to 6.4. I mean, nobody's that stable. Their growth rate's probably a lot slower. And like I said, I think there are fundamental problems there with their whole growth model in centralizing the economy and depending on housing. So you could have a very significant slowdown in China that lasts for a long time. Not necessarily a crisis, just a significant slowdown. Obviously, it will hit Australia, but it'll hit Europe, and it'll also hit the U.S. So if there's a this time is different place, referring to my title of my book with Carmen Reinhart, it's got to be China.
Peter Brain, how do you receive that? Because you, in your latest book, Credit Code Red, you were quite a lot more concerned, particularly about the role of debt in Australian households' lives.
And at the epicentre of this is a view that's different from the one you've given. I'm much more pessimistic about the US for three reasons. Firstly, this year, the current federal budget deficit, a percent of GDP, is reckoned to be about 4.5% or just under $1 trillion US. And that's given, unless there's fundamental changes to the current fiscal settings like tax rates and expenditure policies, that's continued to go on into the never-never. So that by the 2030s, the US, on current projections by the Congressional Budget Office, will have a public debt held by the public equal to what it was in World War II. This can't go on. The second thing is that there's the overhang, as you mentioned, from quantitative easing, which is the excess reserves held by the banks at the Federal Reserve, which has the capacity to generate a level of credit equal to the whole US GDP, which the Federal Reserve is trying to mop up before things like inflationary shocks start moving that credit potentially to actual outcomes. The third thing about the US is which in my view makes it almost a basket case, defined by the fact that it's so severe that the sort of structural measures required to sustain sustainable growth is unprecedented on the historical record, and that is simply distribution of income. Since the Reagan tax reforms of the 1980s, the US 1% has captured about 70% of the increase in the US income pre-tax, which means that their share of overall income has gone from 10% to now about 23%. They'll probably get 100% this year. So just to stabilise the increase in the income share going to the 1%, which is sucking economic innovation and everything out of the economy, you'd have to reduce the marginal share to about 25%. Now, the only time that's happened on the historical record was in the Second World War, where the US got into a similar situation in the 1920s, and with the income for the 1% being similar to today. And the only thing that's fixed that was the Second World War, which allowed the US policy authorities to impose rapid compression of wage market differentials, marginal tax of 60 to 80% to prevent the top 1% being able to increase pre-tax income in the next year, and profit and price controls, which got the share of the top 1% down to less than 10%. Now, this has to be faced up. It can't go on. At what point does the US distribution income, 25%, 1917.
This is the Piketty argument. Okay, Peter Martin, I want to turn to you because you did a marvellous overview, I think it was late last year or early this year, of 25 of Australia's economists to get a consensus of where they sat. What were the results?
25% of of those surveyed, averaged their answers together, they had a 25% chance of a recession in the next 2 years. Now, before I joined the conversation, I did these annual surveys for the Age and Sydney Morning Herald, and we're about 20%. Now, I should point out that you'll never have any reasonable person having a 0% chance of a recession in the next 2 years. But the concerns are that we managed the slowdown or the end of the mining boom with housing construction, which is now collapsing, really. And there's not much to replace it. Now, whereas in the US, as Ken Rogoff said, you have concerns about the competence, the coordination of the people who would need to manage this. Here in Australia, while one of our arms of policy is great, we've got very low government debt, lots of ability for the government to go back into deficit, to spend big. The Reserve Bank has cut interest rates to close to nothing, 1.5%. They'll probably cut them just a bit more to around 1%. After that, you need to start looking at QE, quantitative easing, notionally getting money in helicopters and dropping it. Other countries have done that. We've never needed to do that. We've never had experience of that. Add to that, again, as Ken said, the greater chance of incompetence in China as more power is centralised, and it was China's reflation spending on housing that got all of that Australian iron ore sent there, and the things that came to our rescue last time don't look as good this time. Now, if there is a recession in Australia, and there should have been several times in the early 2000s, 2008, we managed to avoid one. If there is a recession in Australia, it'll come from a worldwide downturn. We've escaped the last two. We are unlikely to have the tools or the luck that we had last time.
Okay, I want to give Peter Brain, if you can just limit yourself, because I want to go back to Ken Rogoff before we finish. But you think there's a credit squeeze underway now, don't you, Peter Brain?
Oh, yes. I back up what Peter said. Is the idea that our future can be cushioned by actions by the Reserve Bank, I think, is fanciful. The banking system roughly now depends about 50% of overseas funding from overseas funds to grow its loan book. Overseas interest rates are rising, and therefore, if they cannot pass on that increased cost to the domestic consumer because the Reserve Bank does not want to increase interest rates, then all that happens, as we're seeing now, you impose a credit squeeze on the economy, and it probably worse than if they had raised interest rates. Mm-hmm. So the capacity now, I see, of the Reserve Bank to cushion the economy through holding interest rates down is fanciful.
Now, final word to you, Ken Rogoff, and I'm sorry, it's just 2 minutes, that you think that what is different is the shadow financial sector, banking sector, is a bit different. But if I can quote you, big banks seem to have less risk on their books. So I suppose that's a good thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there's a case to be made that they maybe regulated the big banks too aggressively and allowed too much risk to go into the shadow banking sector. There are some people who say that there are secret agreements, implicit agreements, that if the shadow banking sector runs into trouble, it will fall back on the big banks. But at least the regulators claim that that's not true. I think the problem has been actually that small and medium-sized businesses have had trouble getting loans. And at the same time, I do think a problem in the United States related to the inequality problem is they just stopped enforcing monopoly law, antitrust law. They just forgot about it. And I think that's been a big problem in hurting medium and small businesses. It's been a big problem in hurting workers. It's been a big problem in the wage inequality, something that needs to be addressed.
Okay, look, thank you very much indeed. Peter Martin, very fast then, for households listening, I'm getting a sort of sense of steady as she goes, but don't panic.
That'd be about right. Although, as Ken Rogoff said in one of my favourite books, which is This Time It's Different, which opened my eyes, we always think that things are all right and that nothing's going to happen, and it always does.
Yeah. So. Like the housing downturn. I remember watching, and I know Peter Brain, who feels that people should be getting their debt much better organised right now. Look, thank you all very much indeed, gentlemen. Ken Rogoff, thank you to you. Very pleased you could join us. Peter Brain, thank you to you, and Peter Martin, much appreciated.
Thanks.